cloudy, rainy, and seasonal, with a high heading for 56. Tonight, then, sunset will be 7:53. Overnight, cloudy and mild, 50% chance of rain, a low of 45. Friday, cloudy and seasonal, 30% chance of rain, with a high of 59. Quick check on the weekend for you. Saturday, partly sunny and 57. Sunday, sunny and 63. So here are the numbers right now. Wind east at 11. Rain in many parts of the listening area. 49 degrees Kenosha. 47 in Racine. 48 to the west for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. It is 10 past 8. The morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm really excited to be able to spend the next few minutes of the program with four people from the University of Wisconsin Parkside, right up the road from us, a member of the faculty and three noteworthy students. These students have in common an excellence and interest in undergraduate research work, and all three of them have been recognized for that work and participated in an exciting event in Madison a little bit earlier this spring called Research in the Rotunda, in which a number of students from across the UW system were recognized for the important work that they were doing in undergraduate research. And at least a couple of our guests recently went to a national event in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, the National Conference on Undergraduate Research. So we're going to be talking today about what it means to do research at the undergraduate level, how it can even be possible with all of the other obligations that sort of press in on every kind of student. What does it mean to take on research on top of everything else? And we'll find out a little bit about each of the research projects that these three students from Parkside are doing. We want to begin, however, the introductions with the gentleman who kind of led the way, namely Dr. David Higgs, who is professor of biological sciences at Parkside and also faculty coordinator for undergraduate research. And I reached out to Professor Higgs, and he was kind enough to help facilitate this morning show conversation today and to issue invitations to three students: Mallory Farmer, who is a senior psychology major, Connor Alton, who is a senior biological sciences major, and Magnus Schroeder, who is a junior chemistry major. And again, all three of them have been recognized for their outstanding work in research at the undergraduate level. So we have a lot to talk about, and we welcome all four of you to the morning show.
Great. Thank you, Greg.
Thank you.
Good to have you here. So, Professor Higgs, first of all, I would love to just learn a little bit more about you in terms of where you are from originally and kind of your professional path that ultimately led you to Parkside, where you have been teaching for a few years.
Yeah, great. Thanks, Greg. So I grew up in Platteville, Wisconsin, and then through various stints did undergraduate work in Minnesota and Iowa State, and then postdoc out at Cornell University. And then I started at Parkside about 26 years ago, so I've been a faculty since 1999 at University of Wisconsin Parkside and in the biological sciences department. My area that I really focus on research-wise is more genetics, molecular biology, plants and algae. We work with the single-celled algae called Chlamydomonas reinhardii. But it's really trying to understand the basic molecular biology, genetics of how algae and plants respond to light, environmental conditions at the molecular genetic level. So we do a lot of molecular genetic research in the lab looking at those different aspects.
How did you first become interested in the biological sciences?
Well, that's a long story. But I had a great high school teacher at Platteville, and that really kind of got me interested. And we were doing crosswords with fruit flies, you know, as junior and senior years. And so I think I kind of stuck doing that. And I did a lot of work for a plant breeder in the area and stuff. So I kind of got an interest in that a long time ago. And then I think that stuck in both my undergrad and graduate work. It became clear that's what I wanted to focus on in that process.
Very good. So you're certainly in a field in which research is always going on and always a part of what the whole field is about. To talk for a moment about, for instance, at a place like the University of Wisconsin Parkside, the place that research has, first of all, in your life as a member of the faculty, but then also the place that it has in the academic careers of at least many of the students there.
Yeah, it's a great question. So So as a faculty, most of my effort is towards teaching, but all the faculty, both at Parkside and in many institutes, whether they're large or one institute like UW-Madison or Milwaukee, or a smaller, more comprehensive research still has a central role. It's a smaller percentage of the task at a comprehensive university, but I still think it is central to that learning, staying current with the field, the discipline, and I think it feeds on, the teaching, the research feed on themselves. You know, one informs the other. And also it's a chance to, again, stay current, but then to present newer evidence that's coming out in your discipline, in your field, to students like that are taking classes. And I think that kind of allows students to get interested in it, to see what's current, what's up and coming. So I think it really is connected. The teaching and the research are connected. And so I've always had usually 2 to 3 to 4 undergrad students and sometimes master's students doing research. We have smaller laboratories, but we still have active research programs at Parkside and all the disciplines in that area and stuff. So again, I think they're connected. I think there's a tight link there. And I think that's true across the UW system. The UW system has had a long history of involving undergrad students in research. Oftentimes it's the graduate students, the postdocs that get a little more emphasis when people think about research and, you know, at our R1 Institute. But it's happening at all the UW schools. And frankly, that's part of the reason UW system started the research in the Rotunda about 24 years ago, I think it was 2004, so 21 years ago, to try to emphasize that research is happening at all the institutes. Again, Madison, Milwaukee, but also the comprehensives, including on Parkside. And so that's part of the reason for that event.
So I was going to ask if that event in Madison back on April 2nd was geared very specifically for undergraduate research. And
yeah.
It sounds like
it is strictly undergrad research. And in that event, all the UW schools are allowed 6 spots, that is 6 different presentations. And these are posters, which is a common convention for people to present their research or a project. So it's a 4-foot by 4-foot poster that includes everything from the intro to the background, the methods, the data, conclusions. But it provides kind of an avenue, a venue to present the project that the students are working on. Again, all the campuses have that, including Parkside, and so it's a fun event because it involves you have the administrators from the campuses coming there. You have the legislators. They always schedule around when the legislature is in session, so they try to encourage, you know, senators and representatives, and sometimes the governor stops by.
Wow.
So it's kind of a fun event, and it's in the Rotunda, so it's in that large, it's a beautiful room.
Oh, yeah.
The acoustics has that booming kind of feel to it, so it feels like an active event.
Absolutely, and my understanding is Jay Rothman was there, the head of the UW system. So.
Yeah, usually the president of the UW system there and speaks a little bit, and again, other legislators will stop by over the course of the day to talk with the students, and it's really a chance for the students to interact with the legislator and vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
So the students to inform the legislature what they're doing, what they're working on in that process.
One more question before we actually meet our 3 students. So when, for instance, these 3 students and the others who participated in this, where, in a sense, in the school day does their research work occur? I don't mean so much literally what hour of the day, but I mean more, is this work that's being done within a course?
Yeah.
Or is it sort of a course unto itself to do research?
Yeah.
Or is this, in a sense, almost extracurricular, not in the sense of like playing lacrosse extracurricular, but something that is outside the obligations of the classes for which they're registered? Yeah.
No, that's a great question. I think the answer is yes to all that, and it varies dramatically. And so we oftentimes use the term undergrad research scholarship and creative activity, ERSCA. It's a really kind of a mouthful and kind of a complicated. but it's to emphasize it's not just research happening, say, in a laboratory setting or in the field or clinical psychology area, but it's also the scholarship that the music students are doing, that the theater students are doing, that the art students are doing, whether it's performance art or whether it's, you know, a two-dimensional or three-dimensional art. And so it's covering all the disciplines in that process. So it does vary. Sometimes it's within a class. It may be a project that, you know, the faculty had students doing together, and then the students ran with that project. It may be an independent collaboration, faculty-student collaboration, and that would be kind of the extracurricular. But usually students will sign up for credits for doing research, independent study. Sometimes they're doing it, again, on their own. It can happen in an internship, be it a summer internship or internship during the academic year. We have community-based learning type of projects that students are involved with. So it really runs the gamut. And that's why we try to be all-inclusive, to be welcoming to all those different areas. Because that scholarship can happen in so many different ways.
Wow. So it's a huge umbrella.
And that's true at Parks, but that's true at, frankly, most institutes.
Yeah, very good. For those of you just joining us, we are talking today on the morning show, first of all, with Dr. David Higgs, who is professor of biological sciences at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside and faculty coordinator for undergraduate research. And we also have with us in our studios today three Parkside students who have been recognized for exceptionally fine work as undergraduates in the field of research. And we're going to meet each of them right now. And for no particular reason, I'm going to take them just in the order that they're sitting. So to my immediate left is Connor Alton, who is a senior biological sciences major from Mount Pleasant, a graduate of Case High School. And we're going to find out shortly about his specific research project. But Connor, I wonder if we could just find out from you a little bit about your own interest in the biological sciences and where that sort of comes from, and maybe also what facets of the biological sciences have been especially interesting to you.
Hi, thanks for having me. So my interest in biological sciences didn't really take off until my first or second year of college, actually.
Oh.
Initially, I wanted to go into engineering, which is very different from what I'm doing now.
Yeah.
After meeting a few professors and taking some classes in biological sciences, that is really when I took that turn. Is I was like, wow, this is really fascinating. I just took some intro biology classes, and I was like, something's clicking in my head. You know, engineering wasn't really clicking, but this had a different feeling. So I knew that something I wanted to do was catering towards biological sciences. So what was the other question you asked? Sorry if I may ask.
What sort of aspects of biological science have been especially interesting to you?
I think it's just because now we see such the bigger picture of many things. We see, you know, people or animals walking around. We don't see the tiny things that are really doing a lot of the work.
Mm.
We go, say, into a forest or sampling, and you see, you know, a deer or whatever, but you don't see all the microorganisms inside the leaves, inside the branches, inside the actual deer that are all contributing massively to the environment around them. And I think that's a very fascinating way to look at the world. Yeah. And I really like looking at the smaller aspects of the world and seeing how they interact with organisms and the environment around them.
So you're really interested, as much as anything, in the virtually invisible dimension of what's going on in the natural world, the things for which you probably need a microscope in order to fully understand. Very good. As I said, we'll get to your specific research project very shortly. Right next to you is another senior, Mallory Farmer, who is a psychology major, I believe, originally from Union Grove and a graduate of Union Grove High School. So, Mallory, tell us about your interest in psychology and to what you trace that.
So I became interested in psychology way back when I was 12 years old. I started having my own mental health struggles at the age of 12. And pretty much since then, I knew that that was what I wanted to do. I think when you have your own personal struggles with mental health, you want to help others. Mm. And so since I was 12, I pretty much knew that that's what I wanted to do. And I started Parkside with a declared psychology major. And I didn't really know what area within psychology I was interested in until last year, really. But I always knew psychology was what I wanted to do. I think the people who help people the best are the people who have been through those things themselves. And so that's kind of always the area that I've been interested in.
Wow. So what was it last year that you sort of realized would perhaps be your special focus of interest?
So, unlike the research I do now, I've taken a special interest in forensic psychology, and I'm actually going to grad school to start my educational career in the forensic psychology field, so I'm really looking forward to that.
And can you explain to the layman what that term even means? That's not something I'm familiar with.
Forensic psychology, so it's a branch. There's a lot of different facets of forensic psychology, but overall it's the study of how criminals interact with psychology. It can be forensic neuroscience or forensic psychology. You have criminal psychology. It's kind of a big umbrella of, you know, in its own right. Forensic psychology, pretty much how crime and the brain interact with each other.
Wow. So in a sense, trying to get inside the mind of the typical criminal and maybe find out what was going on.
Why they committed the crime they did. Was it their childhood, environment, things of that sort?
Wow, fascinating. Very good. And last and certainly not least is the one junior in the room, Magnus Schrader. Schroeder?
Either one works.
Okay, all right. Who is a graduate of Burlington High School and a chemistry major at UW-Parkside. So when did chemistry begin to exact its spell over you, Magnus?
Well, honestly, not until I took organic chemistry. Being a pre-med focus major, it's always the one class people tell you to look out for.
Oh, yeah.
It definitely is one where you're terrified of that first class, but I grew to love it through the two semesters, and the lab itself is what really got me into it, the lab we're required to take, and it really just interested me, and I wanted to learn more about what you can do with organic chemistry because it is a massive thing.
Yeah. Can you explain what about it that you found so interesting and or exciting?
It's one of the few sciences that I've studied that's very spatial. Like, everything has a shape, and the shape determines how it functions. And for me, that was really easy to visualize. So it just made the most sense in my head than other sciences I've studied.
Wow, yeah. Well, and I've certainly heard that. I have a brilliant younger sister who's a medical doctor who got all A's all the way through college and all the way through medical school, and she still says the single hardest course she ever took was organic chemistry. It nearly finished her. So there's a whole lot of people who see it that way, but for you, it felt natural and not terrifying at all from the sounds of it.
Yeah, pretty much.
Very good. Well, that sets you apart right there from the crowd. So we want to take some time now to talk about the research that each of you have done. But Professor Higgs, if we can swing back to you for just a moment, help us kind of understand, let's call it the mechanism by which a given student might decide to undertake a particular task, a particular research project. Typically, how does it sort of happen?
Yeah. Eliza, I think the responses and comments that the students have kind of gives you a sense. It's what grabs them, what interests them, what makes sense to them. And part of it is, as the students are taking classes, oftentimes faculty will mention, you know, this is an area that, one of the faculty work on in one of the departments. And so I think through that process, sometimes students become aware of, oh, here are faculty and projects in a broad sense. And then usually it comes down to a student showing an interest. I mean, we will mention, oh, if you're interested in research, talk with your faculty, talk with, you know, different ones to get a sense of what they do. But oftentimes it's the student then reaching out to the faculty to say, you know, I'm kind of interested in doing research. And what are the opportunities? And for them, it's usually that first step. And it's not always clear what are they stepping into, because the process is not always crystal clear. And that process is not clear because it happens so many different ways. But usually it comes down to a student showing an interest. And then usually the faculty say, oh, if you're interested in this, you should talk with these individuals and see what opportunities. So oftentimes that's the first step. And then they usually have a dialogue with the faculty working in an area that they may be interested in. And they may say, yeah, we work on this, and here's some opportunities. You know, does that work for you? And then you start setting up that independent study. And then they start getting involved in the lab. Now, usually it's a branching or spinning off of maybe a class they've had, and so they're familiar with some of the methods. But it really is first stepping into that and then getting more experience. And then over time, they kind of get some independence. As they start doing the methodology, they understanding the process, understanding the experimental design, and then getting that opportunity to work on stuff. And then students get more and more independence. Hmm. And you can see these are students that have been doing research for a while now, so they have that sense of independence. But it usually is a project that is connected with something the faculty's doing, not in a forced way, but in a way that here's some opportunities, here's we have a need for this area, and the student may say, yeah, that looks like an interesting area. So it's a collaborative process.
Right.
It's kind of almost a collegial interaction. Hmm.
The other thing that I think is maybe sometimes a source of misunderstanding for people on the outside looking in, if you will, is I think some people have in their heads this idea that what research really is that initial discovery of something that no one's ever discovered before. I mean, it's that Madame Curie thing. And of course, the reality is that nearly all research is not breaking completely brand new ground. It's not that you need to be researching something that has never been researched before or explored before. And yet, it seems like there should be some aspect of this in which what you're doing is not entirely redundant. I mean, that something new is being achieved or discovered. Can you kind of help us understand how that folds into all of this, especially when it comes to a student choosing a given research project?
Yeah. It's interesting you ask it that way, because sometimes students will come and say, well, I don't have any of my own ideas. I'm really interested in this area, but I don't have this big project, because they have that sense of, oh, I got to come with this, you know, Einsteinian or Madame Curie. I'm going to find something completely new. If that happens, that's great. But I think it's more of pieces and steps. You know, science and the process of science is building from what's known, adding to the puzzle. You know, a common, you know, analogy is it's like a jigsaw puzzle. The edges and the corners are the easy pieces, right? They happen quickly. But you got to fill in the whole picture before you understand what's happening.
Oh, I like that. That's great.
And so sometimes the pieces are, you know, that small piece that's in the middle of a sea, so to speak, or water. It's hard to figure out where it fits. Others click in very easily. Yeah. So I think oftentimes when students come, it's their interest in this area. And then the projects that are happening in labs usually have been going for a while, and it's adding another piece. We need to add more pieces to that to try to fill in that picture.
Mm, very good. So let's learn from each of our students fairly briefly at this point, then we'll dig in deeper for each of you, the research project that you have undertaken and a little bit about how you came to do that. So Connor Alton, again, our biological sciences major in the room, yours is a project involving something with Wisconsin game fish.
Yes.
And having explored a little on Facebook, I know that you are an avid fisherman, so
okay.
I suspect that has something to do with why this is the area of research you were interested in pursuing.
Yes, so I was studying parasites in game fish, so specifically northern pike, walleye, and smallmouth bass. So our family actually owns a cabin up in northern Wisconsin, and I have very easy access to three lakes that I sampled from. And I spent the summer catching those game fish via hook and line methods, and just dissected them back in Parkside for parasites. And you would not believe how much stuff is in those fish.
Mm.
And that's really what's interesting, is that you don't see all that going on. And I say it as each fish is its own ecosystem. It has so many little things going on that you catch a fish and you say, oh, that's a fish. There's a lot more going on than you'd think, and that's very interesting to me.
Yeah. So what prompted you in the first place? I mean, besides the fact that you're a fisherman and around fish and apparently love fish, but besides that, I mean, specifically this matter of parasites within game fish, what sort of sparked that moment of, aha, this is something I would enjoy exploring?
So about a year and a half ago, I took a class at Parkside called Parasitology, which is a study of parasites with a professor that I'm now doing research with. And even within the first week of the class, I knew that this was something I wanted to do. I mean, from the minute she started to the minute the last day of the semester, I loved it. I mean, every minute of the class, I wanted to study for it. I wanted to go to class. I wanted to go to lab. So I knew that I wanted to do something with parasites. And it took me longer than I like to admit to put fish and parasites together. Because at first I was like, I want to do something with parasites, but I'm not sure exactly what. But eventually fish jumped on my radar, and I pursued what I'm doing now.
Very good. I'm anxious to circle back and learn more from you. I want to go to Mallory Farmer. So your research project, if I understand correctly, you as a psychology major, has something to do with media, social media, maybe public media, and and how we look at ourselves. Tell us more exactly what the project was and what prompted you to want to explore it.
Yeah, so the study that I did with my mentor, Dr. Hillard, we were looking at how having a public identity, which is how you construct your sense of self based off of the approval of others, so how that can influence your body image and disordered eating habits when you take into account comparing yourself to others and looking at yourself from the lens of other people. So when you're in a room with people, you're thinking, how are they viewing me right now? How are they viewing my physical body in this space right now? And that can lead to, you know, body image problems because you're constantly thinking about what other people are thinking about you. So
what prompted you to want to explore that? Anything in particular, or is this something that with which you've, in a sense, maybe wrestled with yourself?
Yeah, so like I had said previously, I started having mental health struggles when I was 12 years old, and for me that looked like body image and eating disorder problems. So that subject is near and dear to my heart, and so when I figured out that there was a faculty member at Parkside studying body image and eating disorders, I jumped on that and, you know, said, I want to work with you, because that's something that is very personal and interesting to me, and I think the more research that's done on that, you know, the better.
Yeah.
And we need more of that. So.
Absolutely. I'm sure you're right about that. Very good. Finally, Magnus Schrader, a chemistry major, and your research project had something to do with sunscreen, of all things. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so our project is replacing current sunscreen filters with naturally derived ones, specifically from Corn Bran. How it kind of grabbed me was, and I apologize, I just said something earlier, I actually graduated from Westosha Central.
Oh, okay.
And when I was there, we had a program where we were actually able to build an airplane and then learn to fly it. So I have my pilot's license.
Wow.
So being up there flying in an airplane with a bubble, you tend to need to wear sunscreen because you're exposed to it often. So being able to work with something that I used a lot up there was kind of cool to see how I could make it maybe better or healthier.
Wow. So your project was to see if it's possible to, in a sense, create sunscreens that utilize more natural ingredients versus kind of artificial chemical ingredients. Is that what you're saying?
Correct. The current ones are made from petroleum-based chemicals, so we're looking to switch that over to a plant-based chemical.
Right. And you said we. Why are you saying we? Were you part of a research team?
Yeah, so my professor, Dr. Dimitruko, it's his project. And then I have many other classmates helping me, namely Hunter Zorner, Peter Tagalakis, Regia Cozy, Jacob Christensen. I think that's all of them. It's hard to remember sometimes.
Sure. So research can sometimes be a team sport, then, is what you're trying to
Absolutely,
tell me.
Absolutely, yes.
Very good. Very good. Before we dig into more specifics with each of your projects, I would be curious to hear more generally from the students. Going into this, what was your understanding of what doing research is versus what you discovered, in fact, doing research, in fact, is? Because as we were kind of talking about earlier, I think sometimes we have strange images in our minds of, you know, mad scientists and test tubes and so on. Like, that's what research is. And research, I'm sure, most of the time plays out very differently from that. So anything you want to share in a more general sense, not so much specifically with your project, but just what research is, what you have learned and maybe discovered about what good research is. Anybody? Connor, okay.
So before I took parasitology, I thought research was kind of how you explained it, because the only labs I really had that involved anything to do with research was like chemistry, you know, mixing liquids together and making cool colors and stuff. So I had no idea how research would be that's not like chemistry. But after taking parasitology, I had a very good idea of what my research would be, because I did what I'm doing in my research right now in the class, where I just kind of sat and dissected fish, you know, for 4 to 8 hours a day, which was great, albeit very tiring.
Yeah.
But after that, it's a process of really, I stain my parasites as well, and I consider that part of my research. I basically use a dye to color them to be able to look at their organs and whatnot. that is a whole other process I was not familiar with that I definitely had to develop skills on, because it's very, very particular with how much like substance you use to stain these parasites. So it has definitely developed over the last year and a half for me.
Well, it sounds like it's your particular research is, from the sounds of it, very tactile. I mean, and you really had to develop the technique to do this properly and correctly. Very good. The other two, any thoughts on, you know, the way in which this sort of opened your mind to what research really is versus what you imagined it to be?
Yeah, I also thought research was, you know, crazy hair, test tubes, fun colors, and things like that. I feel like that's how a lot of students go into college, you know, especially undergrad. They don't really know exactly what research is and, you know, all the different types and what it entails. And I, up until I took research methods in my sophomore year of undergrad, still had no idea what it was, really. And, you know, as much as research methods, it's a requirement for many of the majors at UW Parkside and many universities, I don't think it's a great introduction, in my opinion, because there is still so much that research has to offer versus just what you're introduced to in the class working with, you know, 20 other students on the same project. But that was the first introduction I had to real, quote, real research. And it is very different than, you know, especially psychological research. It looks very different from, you know, the hard sciences.
Yeah.
You're not working with test tubes and chemicals and fish and things of that sort. You're working with the mind. And so it's very, very different.
Right, right. How about you, Magnus?
Well, from the other two's answers, my chemistry research has been singled out here. The test tubes and mixing things and crazy hair is very much a part of my life. But for me, I had a pretty good outlook at that. I have a sister who's about 10 years older than me who works in the pharmaceutical industry, so I understood researching a hard science like chemistry involves kind of starting from nothing and you work towards a goal, but to get there, it's maybe taking a bunch of wrong paths before you finally find the thing that works. So I kind of knew what to expect getting into the organic chemistry research, but it's definitely interesting to learn about how other science research happens, because theirs is quite a bit different from the ideal test tubes
research.
To briefly jump in, I think those points are really valuable, and I think Mallory's point about even in a teaching lab, you may get exposure to some of the methods. It's not the same thing.
No.
It's like dipping your toe versus full immersion. And I think the comment that Magnus had, it's kind of an informed trial and error, and you don't know all the paths. And, you know, jokingly, when we say research, it's called that because you're always redoing it and doing it again and again. So there clearly is some tedium, but when you're driven by curiosity and what really interested, that can kind of allow you to push through sometimes the times of tediousness. So,
For those of you just joining us, we are talking about research at the undergraduate level with four guests from the University of Wisconsin Parkside, our neighbors to the north. Dr. David Higgs, who you just heard from, is UW Parkside's faculty coordinator for undergraduate research and himself a professor of biological sciences. Three Parkside students are with us today as well. Connor Alton, a biological sciences major, Mallory Farmer, a psychology major, and Magnus Schroeder, a chemistry major. And we're going to take a few minutes with each of you to find out a little bit more about what you ultimately discovered in your particular research project. So, Connor, we'll circle back to you. And again, you are the fisherman who wanted to do research on the parasites that are found in Wisconsin's game fish. So tell us a little more. You've already kind of touched on some of the mechanics of what you were doing in terms of catching fish and taking them back to Parkside and dissecting them and exploring, you know, what you saw. Talk us through kind of the arc of discovery and where your research ultimately led you.
So at the beginning, as I mentioned before, I have three lakes that our cabin is on in northern Wisconsin, and they're all connected via creeks. So I wanted to catch various game fish from all three lakes and dissect them for parasites to see if the communities of parasites within them changed at all. So say if a parasite community in one lake is the same as another lake, because they're all connected. So that was my overall thought. It was kind of a broad one because it's my first ever research on parasites, so I wanted to have something more broad. So after looking through it, I did figure out that it was pretty much the same. The communities were the same, which is kind of what I imagined. But it really brought into perspective, though, how impactful these organisms are as well. After doing my initial research, I kind of almost branched off to a different question about how this impacts the fish and how it impacts the economics of fishing. So I looked at a bunch of papers online and determined how fish are impacted by parasites and how meat is also impacted. Because a lot of times if you go to, a grocery store and you see beef that says, you know, it came from a grass-fed cow, they tell you that because the way the cow eats and lives matters, and it's the same way with fish. So now I've kind of leaned more into the economic standpoint of this and say, this is an important aspect that we don't look at because we don't see parasites.
Right.
So
it's probably important to say that it's natural for game fish to have parasites living within them. I mean, there is nothing particularly alarming about this. Is there anything noteworthy about it? I mean, in the sense of, I mean, I think you alluded earlier to the fact that there are all kinds of parasites. I mean, it sounds like maybe many more than you expected to find.
Yeah, like you wouldn't believe. So it is natural. So a lot of parasites and fish have co-evolved together, and they've kind of found a medium to where the fish are not dying, but the parasites are getting what they want, so a boundary there. But I also wanted to make it a point that a lot of these parasites were introduced, from what I've read, via people releasing fish from other lakes into new ones. So you could, like, there's stories of goldfish people let out in the lakes that have a parasite that is insanely good at going around and getting transmitted, that has begun a whole thing of infection, and all it takes is one parasite because their whole life is reproducing and making eggs. So it's natural, but it's very important to know not to bring fish from one lake to another lake because it could impact the environment. And as we know with Michigan, invasive species could be very detrimental to the environment. So,
right. Yeah. And do parasites sometimes make fish, in a sense, sick? I mean, do they cause damage depending on what the parasite is?
Oh, yes. There are some that I did catch a walleye one time that had a big old lobe on its abdomen due to having an extreme abundance of a certain parasite.
Wow.
Yeah, and it's very detrimental. And I wish I could watch the fish and see how they actually react, but it's very similar to us, how if we have a lot of parasites in us, we're going to obviously see some sort of a fitness loss. But I can't physically watch the fish and say, oh, this fish actually moved a little bit less than a normal fish would without parasites. But
interesting.
Yeah.
Do you feel like this is a research project that prompts you to want to do more?
To
follow this further?
Yes, I might continue my research after presenting. I might continue it over the summer. And I also want to go find a master's program that does involve this. I've found a few programs like in Florida and whatnot that do relate to fish parasites. So I'm interested in that, and I never want to stop doing this because I absolutely love this.
I can tell. So. Very good. Mallory Farmer, psychology major. Your research, of course, couldn't be more different than dissecting fish and looking for parasites. Again, you were interested in studying the way in which various people's body perception of themselves is shaped. How did you go about studying this?
So it's a little, you have to use a lot of different measures when you are trying to measure what people, you know, their minds. You don't have tangible things, so you have to do a lot of surveys, ask a lot of questions, and just hope that people are being honest with you when answering these surveys and measures. But we used four different surveys when doing our study, and they were measuring things like how much people compare their appearance to others, how much they think other people are looking at them, and what they are seeing when they are looking at them. What kind of identity they have. There are multiple different types. We were specifically, again, focused on public identity, so how you gather your sense of self based on the approval of others. Mm. And then the eating disorder inventory was our fourth measure. So measuring body image and body dissatisfaction and things of that sort to kind of wrap it all up. And what we found is, yes, if you are, you know, constantly worried about what other people are thinking about you, it will impact your body image. It can be positive or negative, we did find, but we were focused on negative. It can negatively impact your body image, and it can lead to disordered eating habits. And the reason that we were so interested in this subject over, you know, other things within the field of body image and disordered eating research is because there isn't much out there on how public identity can impact body image and disordered eating. Hmm. There's a lot of research out there on other topics related to body image and disordered eating, but not necessarily how your personal identity can impact those things. You know, if you have a personal identity, that means you mostly care about how you view yourself, right? Mm. You're not necessarily worried about what other people think of you. You get your sense of approval from yourself, how you're doing, what you're doing. You don't really care about the opinions of others. You know, you care about you for you. And it might seem kind of obvious that if you're constantly thinking about how other people view you, it would lead to body image problems and disordered eating habits. But there's not really much literature out there that concretely states that. And so now we have kind of a foundation to continue research forward on how the different identities can impact disordered eating and body image. Wow. So,
were you surprised that that more of that did not already exist? I'm a little surprised.
Yes, we were actually pretty surprised and shocked that there wasn't really much literature out there. The developers of the aspects of identity questionnaire, which is what we used for the different types of identities, they didn't necessarily create the measure with the intention of using it for body image and disordered eating research. It was used in many other areas of research, but not necessarily this. And so we were kind of shocked, though, to see that there hadn't really been anything out there on looking at how public identity can affect those things. Because, again, it seems pretty, I don't want to say obvious, but it does, you know. And so we were kind of shocked that we didn't really find anything when we were going through our literature review. You know, we found some bits and pieces here and there scattered throughout different research articles about how it could be possible or, you know, things related to what we were studying, but not exactly. So,
wow, fascinating. Well, yeah. That just underscores the importance then of what you've been doing. Very good. Finally, Magnus Schroeder, the chemistry major among us, working on a sunscreen that would be using natural and or biodegradable options. So just sort of talk us through what your research process was. What did you do and how did you and your team do it?
Yeah, so last summer we started in the lab by doing extractions on corn bran to get a particular chemical from its cell wall called ferulic acid. And from there, it's used to generate other chemicals that can be used for many different things. And like I said earlier, it's to replace petroleum-based chemicals with a more natural version. So our proof of concept is the sunscreen, essentially. Mm. So the sunscreen's a side project to prove that you can use these natural chemicals in place of the petroleum ones. So once we started on the sunscreen, and I'm sorry, I'm going to throw out a lot of chemical names here. So
sounds exciting.
There's four main chemicals in sunscreen that act as UV filters, and three of them block the UVB range. So UVB is what gives you like sunburn.
Right.
And those are the ones we replaced for now. The UVA one, that's our next project with these chemicals. Mm. And that's called avobenzone, but right now that is included in our sunscreens that we have made. So from the ferulic acid, we make a bunch of esters from, now I gotta think. 1,3,4-dimethoxycinnamate. There's synapic acid, cinnamic acid, and then the ferulic acids. And from there, we found that a few of them actually ended up being more toxic from a like a cell proliferation assay, basically judges how well cells grow in the presence of the chemical. So those ones we threw out right away. That was the cinnamates.
Right.
And then we found that the shorter the ester was, the more biodegradable it was and the less hazardous to you it was. So we stuck with mostly the phthalates and the 3,4 dimethoxycinnamates.
Right. Okay. Did you end up creating something that you would then slather on your own bodies? I mean, when it came time to figure out how well does this work as a sunscreen? I mean, was it as basic and simple as that?
So, no. Our teacher would not let us test them on ourselves, but we did actually create a sunscreen for each of the chemicals we made. So we made about 28 chemicals.
Wow.
So therefore, we have 28 sunscreens.
Hmm.
To test UV absorbance, we take essentially like a microscope slide and cover it in the same tape they use to like tape your IV down in the hospital because it's like your skin. And then we put it in a spectrophotometer to measure how well it blocks the absorbent or that range of UV light.
So you're really still interested in the building blocks of this sunscreen.
Yes.
And not, I mean, and somebody else could take those findings and try to concoct an actual sunscreen using what you have discovered. Is that right?
No, so we have made sunscreens, and we used like a traditional formulation to create them. So we do have products that they look like sunscreen, and they function like sunscreen. It's just the toxicity part that we're not quite so sure of yet.
Ah, okay.
But from the one we did, it shows that they would be equally or more safe than the current filters being used.
Wow. So this could lead to something pretty exciting in terms of somebody potentially utilizing this to produce something for the public to consume, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So like I said, we replaced three chemicals with one, and then actually we cut the percent weight in the sunscreen by about 60%, so you're using much less chemical as well.
Wow.
So in theory, it should be cost effective too.
Yeah,
but that's theory still.
Wow, exciting. Well, it sounds like all three of you have explored things that proved to be maybe even more interesting than you anticipated, and all three of you, I suspect, hope that you can go on to do further exploration. I suppose that's a big part of what this whole research experience is like.
Yeah, I think it's gained experience, but as you can tell just from, you know, all three of the students' responses, is they learn skills, they learn some of the fundamentals of doing the research, collecting the data analysis, but in the process, it looks like they've also had advanced the general understanding and knowledge, and that's part of it, is to gain knowledge that then has benefits outside, whether it's a product to be sold, whether it's benefiting health, whether it's a better understanding of environmental or how people interact with themselves. So it helps the students, but also hopefully it can lead to other positive things that's beneficial in the broader sense, the broader community.
Right. And I'm sure it was exciting to be with other fellow undergrads in Madison for the Research in the Rotunda event, and then, of course, for the national event that I know a couple of you did in Pittsburgh to experience some of the research being done by some of your colleagues at schools even across the country. I'm so glad we got to do this. This has been so fun and interesting. Dr. David Higgs, UW Parkside's Faculty Coordinator for Undergraduate Research and Professor of Biological Sciences. Connor Alton, a major in Biological Sciences. Mallory Farmer, a Psychology major. Magnus Schrader, a Chemistry major. It's been great to meet all of you and to talk about this fascinating work you've been doing. And I hope you all have the opportunity to do further exploration and research. And in the meantime, I appreciate you making time in your busy schedules to be on the morning show today. Best
Thank
wishes.
You
Thank
much.
You. Thank you, Greg. Thanks, Greg.
Now 8:59. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. We are your gateway to public radio, and we are Wisconsin Public Radio for the southeastern corner of the state. We'll join Wisconsin Public Radio for the news and then Wisconsin Today. Here's the forecast details from the National Weather Service. Going to be one of those days, cloudy, rainy, and seasonal. Today's high heading for 56. Right now it's raining. Wind is from the east at 11. It's ugly out there. 49 degrees Kenosha, 47 for Racine, 48 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. The news and Wisconsin Today up next.